Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
I think there's a lot spoken that seems to say if only church leaders were bolder, stronger, more forceful, government would do what they wanted. Actually, we weren't in that position at all. We were in the position of government having made decisions that were going to be imposed. They listened to our concerns, they listened to our objections, but in the main largely ignored them.
It is our responsibility to engage our minds and also to open our Bibles and to do our theological reflection as well. And if we're being told something that's highly questionable from an epistemic or an epistemological perspective, we don't have to simply accept it just because it's being told us by the government.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome to today's show, aiming to bring you, as usual, thoughtful conversations on important subject, bridging the Christian secular world today. Did the church give away too much control to the government during COVID, we're asking today, and we'll be talking about the Frankfurt Declaration as well. I'll introduce my guests in just a moment's time. Lots of response to last week's show, our big panel discussion on church leadership and abuse. That's available over on our website via podcast and video if you want to check it out again, premierunbelievable.com. And I'll read out some of your thoughts towards the end of today's show and hear feedback from some of our other recent shows as well. And did you know we finally launched a proper Twitter account for all things Premier Unbelievable? Up till now, I've tweeted primarily from my own account, but you can now follow @unbelievablefe. To keep up to date with all of the content we're now producing beyond just the Unbelievable show. The FE, by the way, stands for Faith Explored, so that's Unbelievable FE on Twitter. Faith Explored is the strapline of our new ministry. So happy tweeting, following, and so on. And again, you can find all of that at our website, including a free ebook, ways to support us, and our newsletter too. PremierUnbelievable.com. Let's leap into today's show. Today, we're talking about COVID and Christians. Did the church give away too much to the state? As the global pandemic begins to subside, many churches are still feeling its after effects, especially in reduced numbers at worship services. But during the crisis, some church leaders were openly critical and even rebellious about the government restrictions that were imposed on gatherings. In fact, a number of church leaders recently signed the Frankfurt Declaration of Christian and Civil Liberties, concerned at what they see as state overreach into the vicinity of the church. One of those who signed is Jamie Franklin. He's a Church of England priest who co-hosts the Irreverend podcast. He's been critical of his own church and the national response to COVID, believing that it's set a dangerous precedent for government overreach. On the other side of today's discussion is John Stevens, National Director of the FIEC, the Fellowship of Independent Evangelical Churches in the UK. Now, John has encouraged churches to abide by the government mandates and has supported the rollout of the vaccination programme. So as the dust begins to settle and COVID remains a polarising issue among Christians, we're asking, did the church give too much away? So John and Jamie, welcome along to the show.
Hi, Justin.
Thank you, Justin.
Let's get your background a little bit. John, tell us about FIEC and your role there first.
FIEC is a national grouping of about 630 independent evangelical churches all across the country. FIEC is not a denomination, so we don't control the churches. We can't tell them what to do. We provide advice, help and support. I've been national director for 12 years. Before that, I was pastor of a church in central Birmingham. So that's my background. By background, I'm a lawyer. So I was converted when I was a law student at university. So my background is in law, particularly charity law and charity governance, but I've been leading FIEC now for 12 years.
And you've obviously been very involved as an organisation helping churches through the last 2 years. What's been the overall effect that you've seen on the churches in your network, John?
In honesty, as we come out of it, I think we've been really encouraged. I think it's been obviously a massively testing time for churches, but I think many of our churches weathered the COVID crises remarkably well. They're essentially word-centred churches, and we're able to move very rapidly onto kind of online platforms to enable people to hear the word taught, to engage with one another through Zoom. That's not that they wanted to do that. They would ideally have wanted to meet physically. We're committed to wanting to gather as the people of God to praise, to hear his word, to celebrate the sacraments. But in the particular circumstances that we faced, the vast majority of our churches were able to move very rapidly into an online format. Most of our churches met as much as they could within the restrictions. So actually, it was a relatively limited period of time that churches were actually required to close. And then they were able to open with various limitations on what they could do. And most of our churches took the opportunity to meet as much as they possibly could. So even if they couldn't meet physically as church, they would gather as groups of six in gardens or outside for prayer, for fellowship. As soon as it became possible to meet together, they were willing to come back together, even with the restrictions of face masks and the restrictions on mingling. So generally, many of our churches took maximum opportunity within what the law was allowing to meet whenever they could do that. I think quite a lot of our churches have seen significant growth over this period. There are people who have been attracted to church by watching online services, and they've sort of seen gospel proclamation, gospel faithfulness, and there's been quite a lot of movement into churches as a result of that. And honestly, I would say over the last 2 years, we've had more reports of conversions and baptisms over this 2 year period than actually I've seen in the 10 years before that. So it's been a really difficult time for churches. There are obviously massive challenges. Churches have lost people, fringes have disappeared. It's been difficult to remobilize teams of volunteers back together. But at the same time, there's been those blessings of kind of growth, gospel focus, conversion. So I think this has been a time of refining for many of our churches. Smaller churches and churches with weaker leaderships have really struggled. And there have also been some remarkable examples of kind of love and service. So churches serving the community through support groups, through kind of food banks. In many churches, people have made a huge effort to include people who are elderly. So, for example, there were churches going around giving people laptops, helping them to be able to kind of engage into kind of services. And those, I think, have been wonderful examples of love and care in what was an extraordinarily difficult situation.
Great. Thank you very much, John. Jamie, tell us a little bit about your own church background and, yeah, what you saw during the lockdown, especially in terms of your church and the churches that you've engaged with.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Justin, for having me on. And I appreciate this conversation very much. I'm very grateful to John being here as well. I'd like to say at the beginning that just make it clear that I'm part of the Church of England. So we're a different organisation to John's organisation, and we will have had different institutional responses to what happened. So my remarks aren't really directed at John necessarily. And John, we've never met. We just had a nice chat before we were recording, which was very pleasant. And John seems like a very godly man. And I really hope this is a productive conversation. I already feel very pleased to hear John saying about the fact that their church has met as much as possible, given the restrictions that were laid upon the church at the time. So that to my mind is a very good thing. My background, I'm actually a sort of culturally evangelical Christian. Found my way into the high church of the Church of England during the ordination process, really. And I've not been ordained for very long. I'm a fourth year curate, so I've only been on the ground in parish ministry in this role for 3 years, but I have had lots of experience in ministry in other contexts as well. I'm in a parish in Nottingham, and very differently to John, I'm not involved in any kind of official high-level institutional response. All I can do is give my perspective as someone on the ground and as somebody who's thought about this and you know, give my own experience from that perspective, I suppose. So is that enough for that question, Justin? Or would you like to ask me?
Yeah, absolutely. But I was going to say, with the Irreverend Pod generally with some of the things you've been writing and talking about, I think you've become a bit of a sort of rebellious voice in the Church of England. So tell us about sort of, you know, what perhaps, you know, maybe take us through the early time, you know, how the initial response, as it were, in the that first lockdown, and what your feelings were, and how things developed from then.
Yeah, sure. So I think, Justin, I found the initial response, well, I have to try and choose my words carefully, but I was very surprised that there wasn't a more robust response from the church hierarchy when, especially when we were told to close the churches down. It was extremely worrying to me, the institutional response, not just because we acquiesce so readily to the churches being closed down, but the apparent enthusiasm that there was on display. The most well-known example of this would be that clergy were actually, we weren't banned from going into our churches to pray and to live stream services, but we were told that we shouldn't do those things and we should shut our churches completely, even for prayer for us clergy, for we clergy, even though we were still allowed to enter the churches to maintain the buildings and to run food banks from them. Many priests live next door to their churches, or indeed their churches are even part of their own houses. So they're essentially banned from praying in part of their own houses. And this was perplexing to lots of people at the time, because we couldn't understand why it was that there was this apparent enthusiasm for closing down all semblance of Christian ministry and embodied Christian witness in the community at a time when it seemed that we had a great opportunity to be a presence for people in the community, particularly parish churches. And the fact that these great churches, which are all over the country in the centre of their communities, were closed, that their doors were literally shut. People could not go in there to pray, not even clergy could go in there to pray and ring the bells and so on. This was, to me, it was, well, I have to say, it was really quite a devastating moment. It was a really hard thing to live through, emotionally and spiritually. And I suppose the way I would characterize it is to say that it really felt like there was a kind of managerial response from the institution of the church. And there wasn't a sense in which we were being led spiritually or pastorally. We were just told, shut the churches, run a food bank if you want, but don't try and do any sort of embodied ministry. And that was really, that was a really difficult thing, Justin, not just for me, but for many people as well. Yeah. About the podcast, if I could say, we started the podcast in November, I think it was, in 2020. So things have been going on for about 6 months, and we did that really, so it's me and a couple of other clergy who have sort of broadly similar takes on things, because we felt like there was a lack of robust pastoral, spiritual, theological engagement with the culture more generally coming from the church, but specifically at the time from COVID. And we really felt like there was an opportunity there to have a voice in the public square. So we started the podcast, and we've been really surprised actually by how enthusiastic the reception of the podcast has actually been. We have lots of people who listen to us, and even more so than the numbers of people who listen to us, we get messages all the time from people saying, we wish we'd heard this kind of institutional response, specifically from the Church of England, but more generally as well. We were looking for something and the church wasn't giving it to us, and they found that to an extent, I'm sure imperfectly, but in our podcast, in a sense. And the other thing we have a lot is people writing to us and saying they've actually become Christians through this time, even though they've lost any sense of connection that they might have with their local churches. It's something we hear a lot, is people saying, you know, we want to be Christians, or I feel I have become a Christian, but I no longer feel a connection with the church. I don't know how to connect with the church given the institutional response to what's happened. So I don't really know what to make of all of this, but that's where I sort of feel we're at.
Do you sympathise with any of that, John? What's been your experience?
I do sympathise with that, and I think there are differences in ecclesiology. There are different understandings of how the church works and the nature of the church's ministry. There's a difference between a national church and the way that it connects with the community, and FIEC churches would tend to be gathered churches that serve the people who are in membership of them. So that there are different implications for ministry of different approaches. Within FIEC, we wouldn't have the power to tell our churches what to do, and it was the case that the Anglican Church seemed to go further than the law required at the point that that was launched. Although I might say that the difference in terms of practical implication for most ordinary church members wouldn't have been very different in terms of the availability to kind of open. I think it's fair to say that most churches and the vast majority of people at the point of the first lockdown were broadly supportive of it and recognised the need for it. I mean, we were faced with a relatively emergency situation, a virus that people didn't know what the full impact would be. And I think it's fair to say that most people thought this would be a pretty short-term temporary measure to slow the lockdown. So I think some of the judgments that church leaders had to make at the moment of the first lockdown were very difficult because we didn't have the full information. We weren't aware of the full circumstances. It was clear government didn't really want to lock down. There'd been a whole process from January to March of watching the progress of the kind of virus. So when lockdown finally came, I think there was an awareness that this was a reluctant step taken by the government. And at that point, I think it was quite difficult for leaders and churches to oppose that. And I think that actually lots of church members equally felt that it was the right thing. So again, within FIEC, across our spectrum of churches, the vast majority of our church leaders, our trust board, our congregation members felt that that was the right thing to do at that time. So I have some sympathy with church leaders. Also, the reality is, and I found this as a church leader who was engaging with government. Government had made its decisions. And I think there's a lot spoken that seems to say if only church leaders were bolder, stronger, more forceful, government would do what they wanted. Actually, we weren't in that position at all. We were in the position of government having made decisions that were going to be imposed. They listened to our concerns. They listened to our objections, but in the main, largely ignored them. So I think there was also a reality that the church had relatively little power in terms of influencing the government in what it did. From a government perspective, the economy, the hospitality sector, business, work, those were the areas that they were really concerned about. And kind of churches and places of worship were of marginal concern. It's also fair to say that government had to make decisions for all religious groups because of the way that equality works. They weren't just making decisions for the church. They were actually making decisions for all religious groups. And I think that there was probably a greater concern about the spread of the virus within different religious communities. There was a sort of an apparent greater vulnerability of some ethnicities because of the ways that people were living together, because of the ways they were interacting. So government was making decisions not just for churches, but they're actually making decisions for the whole religious spectrum. So whether that be mosques, whether that be Hindu temples. And again, I can understand why government was making some of those decisions, because it wasn't simply a question of churches. Most church congregations are relatively small. If you were gathered for, say, Friday prayers in a mosque, you might have a very large percentage of the community attending. So government was having to wrestle not just with the concerns of churches, but with actually wider issues of how religious kind of bodies would meet and come together.
Yeah. Can I respond, Justin? Yeah. Again, this is just coming from my perspective as somebody in the Church of England and what I witnessed on the ground. But I do understand about the very beginning and how there may have been little information available, although I do think there was some information that was available. I remember reading, for example, some columns by Peter Hitchens, and I think it was Simon Jenkins in The Guardian very, very early on about, for example, the track record of Neil Ferguson, whose model the lockdown was largely justified. But even leaving that aside, I think the thing that was so disheartening from my perspective was the lack of ongoing, or seemingly lack of ongoing, engagement with the serious pastoral, spiritual, moral issues that were involved in the whole process of the lockdown. And it seemed to me, again, you know, just from my position in the Church of England, that what we were really being told by the church, by the institution of the church, was simply to fall into line with the government response. And there was really no sort of differentiation between the government response and the church response whatsoever. And it was, consider one example, supermarkets were open. You know, I went to the supermarket during the lockdown every week. The supermarket had lots of people in it. Now there were lines of people outside the supermarket, but they were nevertheless, they were still open, and they found a way to open. I believe off licenses were open during the lockdown. Off licenses, so people were able to buy alcohol, be in small shops together. As I said earlier, the churches in the Church of England were allowed to operate as food banks. But we weren't allowed to worship, and we weren't allowed to celebrate the sacraments. We weren't allowed to sit under the word of God. We weren't allowed to have evangelistic services. And I think it's that kind of thing, that seeming void there, that sort of torpor that's at the heart of this response institutionally. Again, I don't know enough about the FIC response to comment on it. But that's the thing that I and many other people found so disturbing about this whole thing. It was almost like we didn't want the church to open. It was almost like we wanted this to last for a longer and longer period. And we weren't willing to stand up for the importance and the centrality of Christian worship. To give an example of what a robust response might have looked like, I in preparation for this conversation, I rewatched an excellent series of lectures that was given by Richard Turnbull for the Christian Institute in November 2020. Three lectures: a biblical lecture, a historical lecture providing a historical perspective on Christian responses to the plague, Reformation response, evangelical response in the 19th century, and then a commentary on today's church and the kind of response that we could have to COVID-19. And he engages across the spectrum from a theologically robust point of view on all of it, the scientific aspect as well, the technocratic and political aspect, but also the institutional, the theological, the moral, and so on and so forth. And I think that's the kind of thing that we were lacking during the time. We were not led spiritually in that sense, and that's what was so disappointing from my perspective.
John?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the challenge, I think, here is that actually a lot of public figures who represent the church fail to adopt a robust approach in proclaiming the Christian faith in a whole variety of areas of life. So that's not particularly surprising. There has been a kind of a long-term trend that high-profile public religious figures, representatives of the church, fail to engage on behalf of the Christian gospel with that kind of robust approach. And I think this was probably just a continuation of what is the reality and has been the reality kind of all along. FIEC and most evangelical churches have very little public voice. We're not sort of the voice that's heard. The media turns to the hierarchy of the Church of England or Catholic hierarchy. We are largely ignored, despite the fact that evangelicals are the growing sector of the Christian church. So there's a whole swathe of churches out there and Christians out there who would hold a much more robust view, whose voice is not heard in the kind of media. And I think we were very aware of our absence in that public profile. I think there's a challenge here that there are two separate issues that kind of come together. One is, there's no doubt that for the government, worship and the gathering for worship was not seen as being something essential. And I think that to some extent we need to recognise that that is a reality in a secular society, that we are in a situation in which kind of churches have dramatically declined. They are relatively marginal to national life. And I think it's a wake-up call to us to realise that in the minds of the wider public and the minds of the government, what we think is essential is not regarded as being essential. So attending church was not seen as being the equivalent of going shopping in Sainsbury's. It was seen as more of the equivalent of choosing to go to the cinema or choosing to go out for a kind of a meal, a recreational activity that had been stopped for most people. And I think we have to recognise that that's what government thought, and it was very difficult to persuade them otherwise. I think it's right that we as Christian leaders want to highlight the importance of Christian worship and the vitality of that. So there's a theological and cultural issue of the place of Christianity, of religion more generally, within society. The other side is, even if you think it is important to be able to gather for worship, that raised the question of whether in these circumstances it was reasonable for worship to be suspended for a period of time. And I think actually the mix between what you might call the theological cultural biblical principle and the reality of a health crisis and how to respond to that is really quite complicated to work through. So again, I have some sympathy for the government. I'm not sure that going to church, participating with a group of people, being together for a period of time in the same building is quite the same as going to Sainsbury's and shopping and a quick in and out in which you might meet a smaller number of people. It's a different form of gathering. And in many of the churches that I know, where you would have congregations of hundreds, quite frankly, those would be spreader events in that situation. So if you're a small parish church with a small congregation and lots of space, you might say that would have been possible to meet in a safe way. And when eventually things were opened up and rules on mixing and mingling were introduced, it was possible to do that. For lots of evangelical churches that are full to bursting, actually, they wouldn't have been able to carry on in the way that they had been carrying on. So again, I think that the principle and the practicality are two slightly different questions. And I think the issue the government was wrestling with, which I have some sympathy for, is what is a reasonable response to the risk posed by this pandemic that we don't quite fully understand? And it's easy to look back with hindsight and say wrong calls were made, to say that an overly risk-averse approach was taken. I think it's much more difficult for people to actually make that judgment at the moment. And they deserve some measure of sympathy for having to make a very hard call in the interests of the wider public.
I hope that I conveyed, John, in my comments earlier that it was a very difficult time right at the beginning. And what I was trying to say is from my perspective, it was the ongoing institutional response that lasted many, many months, if not over a year, and has been, largely speaking, doubled down on now, if I can use that past tense in that way. Well, can I just come back on just a couple of things? I hear what you're saying about in a secular society, the government not considering Christian worship essential. And I don't know what was going on behind closed doors, but I didn't really hear anyone in public insisting that Christian worship is essential for the good, not only of Christians, but of society as a whole. You know, we gather together to render to God his due. This might be more of an Anglican ecclesiology, but we do it on behalf of the people who are not doing it as well, to intercede for them and to intercede for our nation, that they might turn from their sin and come to join us in the true and just worship of God. And so to have a government that considers the worship of the church, Christian worship, non-essential is not an acceptable state of affairs. Go on, Justin. Sorry.
But you could do what you're describing there, Jamie, on Zoom. You know, people can pray, they can intercede, you know, because we have the technology. And a lot of people, you know, especially during the early days of the pandemic, you know, we're thanking God, you know, for the fact that this pandemic at least had come at a time when we can actually, the majority of people could do that online. So what for you is the big difference between sort of that way of doing it and the fact that you've obviously felt the limitations of in-person?
Okay, yeah, I mean, I can make two comments about this. I think the first thing I'd like to say, Justin, is from a legal perspective, when my friend William Phillip and a number of Scottish church leaders took the SNP to a judicial review, the secular judge said that online worship does not constitute worship from a legal perspective. And that would, he described it as worship light, L-I-T-E. So that would hold for this country as well, because our constitutions are so similar. I have it on good authority that this would, if a similar judicial review were brought in this country, which was in preparation actually at the time by Christian Concern, it would almost certainly be successful for this reason. So there's a legal thing there. But I also think we have to say theologically that online worship cannot be considered the equivalent of the gathered congregation of God. And I would argue even from a lower church perspective, we still all agree that, for example, the evangelization, baptism of new converts, the taking of the Lord's Supper, however we understand that, fellowship, as it says, you know, all of these are marks of the early church in Acts chapter 2. The internet hadn't been invented, obviously, but they were talking about real in-person fellowship, the cut and thrust of forgiveness and reconciliation in the Christian community, the supporting and helping of weaker brethren and people in need, the care for widows and orphans. All of these things are critically impaired if people can't leave their houses and can only meet on Zoom. So the very best you could say for Zoom is that it enables a disembodied conversation, and that's all great. You know, I run a podcast on Zoom, we're talking on Zoom now, it's all brilliant, but it's not a replacement for the gathered church of the living God, an embodied Christian community.
I'll come back to you, John, for a response on that in just a moment. We're going to go to a quick break, and we'll be back. We're talking about COVID and Christianity. Did the church give away too much to the state? And generally, we'll be looking, you know, as we head out of this current pandemic, whether the church has given away too much. What are the next things that may be a concern to people like Jamie? John Stevens is also with us from the FIEC, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's edition of the show. COVID and Christians. Did the church give away too much to the state? We're asking today. Jamie Franklin is one of my guests. He's a Church of England priest who co-hosts the Irreverend podcast, and he's been critical of his own church and the national response to the COVID pandemic. Thinks it may have set a dangerous precedent for government overreach into worship, into something that he believes is essential for the moral health of the country as a whole, not just for individual Christians. On the other side of today's discussion, though agreeing with certain aspects of what Jamie has to say, but perhaps more open to the idea that there was a necessary response at the time, especially of the early lockdowns, National Director of the FIEC, John Stevens, is with me. And John, happy for you to respond to what Jamie had to say there. But one thing I did want to bring up is the fact that there were at least some instances of churches and church leaders breaking the rules. Perhaps most famously in the US, John MacArthur, who has a large church out in California, got into a real tussle with the local authorities because they continued to meet. I think initially they sort of obeyed by the rules, but as that went on, they decided actually they were going to meet, and they got into various tussles. And there was both support and criticism from him in the US. Other stories in the UK included one church in North London, Angel Church, which was taken to task for breaking the rules for meeting. Marcus Walker within the Church of England, the priest at St. Bartholomew the Great in London, defied his own church's specific instruction not to go into the sanctuary and did actually live stream prayers and so on, even while not having a congregation present and so on. So I'm sure Jamie will want to comment on some of those examples. But John, what's your thoughts on churches that did decide to, as it were, take some kind of civil disobedience into their own hands?
I can come back first of all just from what Jamie was saying beforehand. Please. Just a couple of comments about that general principle. I think that how you felt about the lockdown is determined by your ecclesiology and your understanding of the mission of the church. And I think actually what the COVID crisis has done has revealed that you can't put all churches together as if they are all the same. They all will have a different view. So, for example, I think within the Anglican Church, some of the Anglican Church has much more of a sense of the church to the nation, the priestly vocation of the church as a whole, its presence there, its praying for the nation. And that is seen as its raison d'etre, which of course is affected by a lockdown. I think lots of nonconformist churches, the church exists primarily for the people who belong and attend to that church, and the way they seek to reach the nation is through the sharing of the gospel. Of course, still praying for the nation, but it's not seen in quite such a priestly sacramental way, which means that the church is able to continue its ministry in other forms, whether that be online or whatever. Again, I would want to say, I don't think that any of our churches thought that online was a replacement replacement for physical worship. There was a lot of debate in this kind of crisis about, you know, consumer Christians and is everybody going to want to be sitting on the sofa at home with a cup of coffee rather than coming to church? And I think actually there are some sections of evangelicalism which are consumerist. I think some of the churches that have suffered most in this period are those for whom their gathering is primarily the equivalent of a mass pop concert. They have large numbers of attenders who want to come for that, for the experience. They're not really committed, engaged church members. And those churches have struggled because essentially church is a consumer experience. So there are some elements of that within evangelicalism, but nobody in our churches was saying, oh great, we're going to move to online worship because that's going to be so much better and more people are going to be able to come and you're not going to have to turn up. Actually, it was a temporary provision for which we were grateful in circumstances in which we couldn't do what we would want to do on an ordinary basis. So I think ecclesiology matters as well. Legally, Jamie talked about the kind of the judicial review that took place in Scotland. I followed that case quite closely, and the court there did conclude that the Scottish regulations were unlawful. But it's really interesting to understand why they decided that. They decided that because the Scottish government hadn't taken into account sufficiently the legal principle of the right to freedom of religion. And under the kind of Human Rights Act, the European Convention on Human Rights, in England we have a protection for freedom of religion and worship. But that's not absolute. It is balanced against the public interest. And what the court concluded was the government hadn't shown that it had sufficiently taken that into account in making its decision. They didn't say that government couldn't close churches, that would always be inappropriate. It's actually a balance between the risk and the freedom as those rights conflict. And very interestingly, in the Scottish case, in order to win, the people who were bringing the case conceded on singing. So one of the big issues for churches was, should we be allowed to sing or not sing? To get the result, the people who brought that case accepted that government could be entitled to direct that churches should not sing. So it's in some ways it's a bit of a Pyrrhic victory. And I think the same would be true in England if a case were brought here, that there is a principle of balancing our freedoms against the protection of the public. And that's always been the case, whether in times of plague, illness, war, certain restrictions on our freedom of religion have been permitted. So that's just my comment on that situation. Now, again, I want minimal restrictions necessary. And I think at points, the government's approach, its guidance, was far too long-lasting. Measures were kept in place for which there was relatively little justification. And I think that is true of the crisis as it unfolded. In actual fact, when we came to the second and the third lockdowns, churches were much more permitted to remain open than had been the case in the first lockdown, which is precisely because the government knew that there was that balance between public protection and freedom of worship. And therefore, they didn't restrict churches, particularly in the third lockdown, in the way that they restricted other elements of society, like, for example, hospitality venues, cinemas and theatres. So to some extent, our legal rights were reflected in the way that the regulations were crafted in the subsequent lockdowns. I think in relation to churches that chose to disobey, in the UK, there were very few churches that chose to do that. To my knowledge, very few that actively decided that they were going to break the law. It was difficult because there was a mix of law and guidance. Some things weren't legally required. They were guidance, but that was quite complicated because the guidance was also part of health and safety regulation. Within FIEC, we took it as our view to primarily tell our churches what the law and guidance required. Obviously, it's up to them to decide how to implement that. But the view that the majority of our churches took, the view that I took, was that we have a duty to obey the law unless it's in direct conflict with the commands of Christ. And I think our judgment was that because of the nature of the circumstances in this instance, we didn't see there as being a conflict between what government was requiring and what Christ required, what the Word of God demands. Although we could see that if the restrictions became repressive, they weren't removed as quickly as possible, we could have been in a situation in which we might have thought that was the case. But mercifully, the government did remove the restrictions, and of course, they're no longer there. In this country, there were a very small number of high-profile cases. I think rightly, Christians tended to pursue a legal route of judicial review rather than simply disobeying the law. The case of the church in Angel is fascinating. I know a little bit about that case. It was a church that they appeared on the Sunday programme on Radio 4 saying, we're going to break the law. We don't believe these laws. We're going to meet. the police then turned up to their gathering. Their response was very interesting. They then said, oh, we're not breaking the law. We're having sort of support group meetings. And actually half the congregation met inside the building and half outside, which is kind of ironic because having made that great stand, when it came to it, what they told the police was, we're not breaking the law at all. So even that apparently high profile case of some kind of deliberate flaunting of the law actually turned out in the end to be people saying, we're making use of the sort of support group kind of provision, which is especially for people who are sort of vulnerable drug addicts, mental health illness issues, which wonderfully that church is reaching many people from that background. So even a high profile case in England that appeared to be breaking the law, when it came to the crunch, they made the argument that they were actually complying with the law. Now, I think America is very different. It's different culturally. It's different legally in terms of the rights of churches. Different states adopted different approaches. I do think there is more of an anti-government, anti-authoritarian strain within American culture and American Christianity. I understand why Christians want to assert the right to be able to worship. I think some of the spokesmen in the states, that was mixed up with a denial of COVID. It was mixed up with attitudes of whether or not COVID was a serious threat or not. And I think in much of the discourse, the theological principle got very mixed up with issues of whether or not COVID is a real kind of risk. And I think that it was quite hard to see your way between those two positions.
Yeah, just to say about the legal case in Scotland, I think it's going slightly far to call it a Pyrrhic victory, considering I think you even just said yourself, John, that it was at least in part the reason why the church was allowed to stay open during the third lockdown. So that seems to me to be a very significant victory rather than a Pyrrhic victory. In terms of the legal thing, I think there's... the theological point I think we would have some agreement on is that the civic authority from a biblical perspective probably does have in some circumstances the right given by God to tell Christians not to worship under certain circumstances. So, for example, this is an example I read on Doug Wilson's blog, who's a pastor in America. You imagine that there's some kind of sniper on the other side of the road to a church, and he's about to open fire, and the police know about this. Now, they go into the church, and they say to the people, get out of the church right now, because somebody's about to kill all the people in here. You should obey from a biblical perspective what is going on, because there's a serious, imminent, tangible threat to the church right there and then. But if that happened for 10 Sundays in a row, say, and there was no real evidence that there was a sniper outside, or it was at least highly questionable that there was one, you might think again. Now, I'm not drawing an exact analogy with COVID. I'm just trying to bring some clarity to the situation from a scriptural perspective. Clearly, there are times when you should obey, but those times are very, very exceptional and extreme. And the question in the case of the COVID situation, I have to say, John, I do think it's important that we do engage not just with the official line from Chris Whitty and whomever over, you know, how many people are going to die if we do X, Y, and Z, but a more general balanced and robust take on what we're being told. The question is the civil magistrate overreaching his legitimate authority to close the church? And I think that once you're in a position where you answer yes that question, then from a scriptural perspective, you would probably conclude that you should keep your church open, because we are commanded by God in scripture, unless there are these exceptional circumstances, to meet together and worship God. Now, I'm not making a comment about when that line has been crossed, but I would say that that is the framing of the issue. The other thing about the American situation is the argument, I think, would be that in Romans 13, we're told that God has instituted government to bring justice via the sword, to bring order and so on and so forth. Now, what I imagine somebody like John MacArthur would say is that what was actually going on was unconstitutional. So the order which God has put in place was actually being subverted by the actions of the state government, or whomever, or, you know, the president or whomever. So it's actually a question of upholding the order, the civic order in the US. I wouldn't like to go on any further on that, because I'm not an expert in constitutional law, but I think that there's a scriptural principle there as well.
I mean, what do you make of John's point, Jamie, though, that it was also there was a certain amount of mixed in with that questioning of, you know, just how serious the COVID pandemic was. And I've got to say, my timeline, you know, it was often Christians who were in the US, especially questioning, you know, the narrative around that. I think you've probably questioned exactly what the narrative is on that as well. And to that extent, do you think the church on both sides of the Atlantic or whatever has been too much kind of simply following, you know, the official pronouncements from the top?
I think so. Has the church been too much following the official line? I think so for sure. I think we can see even now, Justin, that there's a retrospective critique of what happened. I mean, I'm sure we're all aware of Rishi Sunak's comments over the last couple of weeks, trying to distance himself from the decision to lock down, and indeed Liz Truss as well. So I believe that retrospectively, the narrative is actually changing, and the tide is turning on this one. But certainly at the time, it is our responsibility to engage our minds and also to open our Bibles and to do our theological reflection as well. And if we're being told something that's highly questionable from an epistemic or an epistemological perspective, we don't have to simply accept it just because it's being told us by the government. I gave the example of the Neil Ferguson model. Now, I don't think anyone really denies that model, which was produced, I think it was on the 16th of March 2020, that model was the initial justification for the lockdown in the UK and in the USA as well. And we had a pre-pandemic plan. You can go on the government website and read the pre-pandemic plan. It clearly talks about mitigating against the virus, but also seeing society carry on as normal. It talks about the importance of keeping the economy open and so on and so forth. The idea of the lockdown really came from China, from the Chinese Communist Party. It was wicked beyond description. It was first implemented in Italy, and then it was implemented here on the basis of Ferguson's model. Now, this is not a conspiracy theory. Neil Ferguson himself has actually said that he didn't think that we could get away with this in this country because it would have been too draconian. So I'm just giving you some idea of the reason that people were uncomfortable with this. And I think as a Christian, as a part of the church, it's entirely legitimate to say that we can comment on these things prophetically and say that, and question at least, whether this is for the common good of society or whether it's actually more damaging to implement these things than not.
John.
Can I come back on a couple of things Jamie said? I think this question of the authority of the church and state and how those relate is a really important kind of question. And I think Christians tend to sort of fall into two different categories. And again, it's important to distinguish these. Some people seem to adopt an absolute view. They basically take the view that the state has no role over the church at all. It has no right to be able to interfere. It has no right in any circumstances to shut worship, to tell churches that they cannot meet. That seems to be represented by the kind of Frankfurt Declaration that's been sort of recently issued by a group of Christian leaders, predominantly from the States, but also in Europe. It seems to adopt that absolutist approach. There is the state and it can have no role in relation to the church. I think most of us actually adopt the position that Jamie said, that in some circumstances it may well be right that government can take the decision that in the public interest kind of worship or the way that church conducts itself kind of should be restricted. And we actually live with a massive amount of restriction and regulation of church life, planning, health and safety, employment legislation, insurance, accounting. You know, you can't do what you want as a church in our contemporary society. You have to comply with a vast swathe of legislation and rules that the vast majority of churches happily go along with. So that then means that the debate really becomes a question of the reasonableness of the measures that are introduced. And I think actually it's really important that sometimes people elevate it to the level of an absolute theological position. Well, if that's your position, then in principle you should be free to meet no matter what's happening, no matter how serious the plague, no matter what the consequences. And I didn't hear anybody in Britain arguing that if this were a really terrible virus that could potentially kill millions of people, we ought to be able to meet irrespective. So much of the debate really is about the principle of reasonableness and proportionality. And I think actually we just need to be clear that that's what's at stake. And the difference between lots of Christians on this was really about whether they thought the measures that were introduced were reasonable in relation to the risk that was being kind of presented. And I think for church leaders, I think of myself in this, actually we're not experts in the science, we're not experts in making that judgment. There were diverse opinions, but there was also a majority scientific opinion. And it's not just Neil Ferguson, there's a whole body of people providing advice. There are a whole group of evangelical kind of doctors, scientists, statisticians who are also reflecting on what's being said. And I think it's worth recognising that judgments had to be made when the facts weren't known. And actually, we do live in a more risk-averse society. And I think when we look back, we'll be able to say, were right calls made? The challenge is you're making that judgment in the light of known facts. Actually, the decisions had to be made at the moment in which you didn't know. You could only really operate on the basis of models and predictions. And of course, the thing that we don't know is it's equally simply a model and a prediction to say what would have been the consequences if we'd done nothing. So the whole evaluation process is quite difficult. And at one level, I think the vast majority of Christians and churches were prepared to trust the government experts, the discussions that were being had, and particularly the fact that we had an intrinsically libertarian prime minister adopting measures that we knew he didn't want to adopt. This was not a government seizing the opportunity to be tyrannical because they could do. We know that it runs against the entire philosophy of the prime minister of the time. And I think that gave some comfort to Christians as government made these choices.
And as you respond, Jamie, I should have mentioned this earlier, but the Frankfurt Declaration is quite an interesting thing. It's this recent statement that's been signed by a number of church leaders across the world, including yourself, Jamie, around the limits, I suppose, of Christian and civil liberties. I could mention some of the articles here, actually. God the Creator as sovereign lawgiver and judge, God as the source of truth and the role of science, mankind as the image of God, God-given mandates and the limits of authority, and Christ as the head of the church. Perhaps you'd like to speak to that. But
yeah, sure, absolutely,
well.
Absolutely. So I was just making a note because I want to come back on something else. So I didn't write the Frankfurt Declaration. I wasn't involved in drafting it. But I think it, broadly speaking, reflects what you might call a sphere sovereignty view of society, which is that there are independent, or let's call them interdependent, autonomous spheres within society under God. So obvious ones would be, for example, the government, the church, the family, and so on and so forth. Now, I'd be surprised, I'm not certain about this, but I'm surprised if anyone would say that those spheres are absolutely autonomous and that they don't sort of have anything to do with one another. There is a certain amount of permeability between the spheres. They sort of, one can affect the other legitimately. So an example would be, for example, that if there is an abusive father in a family or something, it's perfectly legitimate for the state to intervene in that situation. But broadly speaking, they have their own God-given autonomy. The state does not grant the other institutions the right to exist. And I think that's the most important thing. Just because, for example, my family exists in this geographical territory, it is not created or legitimized by the state. And that's the same for the church. The church has its own autonomy, its own independence from the state. And the state shouldn't treat the family, it shouldn't treat the church as though it's in complete and total control of them. And I think that's the concern of the people who have written the Frankfurt Declaration, is that we are lapsing into a totalitarian view of society where the state has total control over everything. And it's all tied into this question of this kind of warlike footing we were put on during the COVID situation. But the worry is, of course, that that will be maintained, that it will be proliferated, mission creep, if you like, the same thing that happened after the First and Second World Wars. So I think that's a serious concern there. But just to bring a bit of clarity, I think that's what they're saying. I hope it is anyway. The other thing I'll just say, just like to come back to this question of expertise. I think one of the points that could have been made at the time is that there was far too much of an emphasis on the scientific expertise of the people who were involved in these decisions. And to me, from the political perspective, it was really an abdication of responsibility when we were told by, for example, Boris Johnson that they were simply following the science. The business of government is to take scientific predictions and so on into account and to balance them against the other considerations and needs of society. To say that the science, I'm not saying you're saying this, John, but I'm just saying to say that the science is the only important thing, the only thing that matters in a society, is to capitulate to a kind of technocratic view, which is that we should just have experts ruling over us and they can tell us what's important in life. It reminds me of a comment by C.S. Lewis in an essay he wrote for The Observer all those years ago called Is Progress Possible? When he said something like, the doctor can tell me the condition I have and the treatment that I will need to cure it, but ultimately it's up to me whether or not life is worth living at that price. So I'm not meaning to frame it in an individualistic way. I'm just saying it's up to the government to take that into account and then to make political decisions which are holistic and not narrowly scientific decisions. And I think there was a serious problem with that rhetoric of following the science for that reason.
I don't know whether for you, John, you feel that things like the Frankfurt Declaration are necessary to kind of reassert the fact that obviously some churches feel there has been this mission creep, as Jamie puts it, and that we need to be clear that actually the church has its own authority and will not necessarily be sort of told what to do by the state. I mean, do you share any of those concerns that this could be a precedent for further intrusions on civil and religious liberties and so on?
I mean, I think actually the principle of religious liberty and civil liberties are hugely important, and they've been long fought for and hard fought for within Britain. They're protected under the Human Rights Act. I think in large measure we've seen the government respecting that, and I don't fear in our context that those religious liberties are going to be overthrown. That doesn't seem to be the way that government is navigating the challenges of being a secular society with a variety of different religious faith communities within it. So I don't share sort of the fear that there is an imminent overturning of civil and religious liberty that seems to underlie the thinking of some of the drafters of the Frankfurt Declaration. I think that probably reflects very much an American context, which is very different. Jamie talked about the whole theory of sphere sovereignty, which I understand, but I think is very much an American perspective. I don't think it basically reflects biblical teaching as to the nature of how the state and church relate, nor Christian history. I think it is a product of the American particular context that kind of seeks to differentiate this separation of powers. It reflects the very way the American Constitution is developed, and pragmatically it may well be a very an effective way of helping society to be able to operate. I think it's been elevated to a biblical principle in a way that's not justified, and I think if you asked Christians in the first century or for most of Christian history if this was the way the Bible described the relationship between church and state, the kingdom of God and the kingdom of the world, they would find it unrecognizable. So I have some really serious theological questioning as to whether or not that is a way of rightly describing the relationship between state and church. It seems to me that it's an ideal and that it effectively represents an over-realized eschatology of what we can expect in this world at this particular time. So to me, I think theologically I have questions about the precise way it's framed, although I also want to protect religious freedom and religious liberty. I actually think that 1 Timothy chapter 2, the way we're to pray for kings and all those in authority so that we live quiet and peaceful lives in all godliness, so that the good news of Jesus, the one Redeemer, can spread, is a manifesto for religious liberty, even in a country which is led by a kind of a pagan, non-Christian kind of ruler and authority. So that concern is great. My problem with the Frankfurt Declaration is its absolutism, that it takes those principles and it absolutizes a version of sphere sovereignty, and then even more than that, absolutizes application in terms of saying the state can have no role in determining how the church conducts its ministry. But the reality is we do that all the time. We're regulated in all sorts of ways. I'd be really interested how Jamie reacts to it as an Anglican, because it seems to me that the Frankfurt Declaration is actually contrary to the very essence of Anglicanism as a state church. I mean, the history of Anglicanism is a state-imposed church with a state-granted doctrine. The doctrines of the Church of England were not decided by the church. They were decided by Parliament that passed the Book of Common Prayer, the 39 Articles. The bishops were appointed by Parliament. So the British relationship between church and state in its Anglican model is utterly opposed to the very way that the kind of Frankfurt Declaration describes the relationship between Christ and church and state. I think it runs counter to all of the magisterial Reformation understanding of the relationship between church and state. So the irony here is, as a nonconformist Baptist, I'm much closer to the Frankfurt Declaration in its understanding. I don't quite understand how those who belong to magisterial Reformation churches, like the Presbyterians and the Anglicans, could possibly find it a document that they could agree with, because it seems to undercut something very significant theologically about how they understand relationship between church and state.
Well, let's come back to you in a moment for that, Jamie. We're going to go to another quick break and then we'll continue talking. COVID and Christianity. Did the church give away too much to the state? We've obviously started talking about this Frankfurt Declaration as well, which a number of church leaders have signed, who are concerned about the impingement of religious liberties by the state. So we'll keep talking about this on the other side of a quick break. You're listening to Unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's show. Coming up later on here on Premier on the Profile, Father Alex Frost is a podcaster, writer, and the vicar of St. Matthew's the Apostle, Burnley. Ordained in 2012 after a mixed career working as a football referee, a manager at Argos, and as a stand-up comic, he'll be telling Sam Hales all about his life and faith. Coming up next week here on Unbelievable, how should we understand Old Testament violence? Paul Copan has written on this issue a lot over the years. Well, his new book is titled Is God a Vindictive Bully? Aimed at reconciling portrayals of God in the Old and New Testament. Well, Randall Rouser thinks that many apologists like Copan are trying to defend the indefensible. And his recent book, God Loves Canaanites, outlines a new way of understanding Old Testament violence in light of Jesus's character and words. So look out for that. Should be a really popular debate on Unbelievable next week. If you can check out some of our other podcasts from Premier Unbelievable, we've got some great material from the past week. On Ask NT Write Anything, I sat down and asked Tom questions like, was Jesus' death on the cross just a bad weekend at human camp? That was a question sent in by an atheist listener. On Matters of Life and Death, Tim and John Wyatt looking at embryology this week, a stem cell, mini-me, CRISPR technology, brave new world, and extending the 14-day limit. So big bioethical issues in discussion there. On the C.S. Lewis podcast, we have the audio from a fun youth event I led in Oxford over the summer as a panel of young people ask their Narnia questions of C.S. Lewis expert Dr. Michael Ward. That's definitely worth a listen. That was great fun. And on Unapologetic, I'm joined by John D. Wise, the philosophy professor who found God after 25 years of atheism. You can hear his story. Loads of great podcast episodes for you from the past week. PremierUnbelievable.com to check them all out. And with your feedback coming up as well a little bit later on the show. Right now, let's get back into our discussion. So we've been talking about COVID and Christianity, looking back at those first lockdowns, whether the church gave too much to the state, whether it had the right kind of voice and approach, whether things were taken into account properly, holistically, and so on. Talking about this Frankfurt Declaration as well. Jamie, you did sign the declaration along with many others. John asked in that last segment whether it even makes sense, though, from the point of view that you're an Anglican priest, and there's obviously been that interaction of church and state historically for a long time there. Can you draw these strict boundaries, therefore, as an Anglican yourself?
Yeah, well, I did say that firstly, I'm not an apologist for sphere sovereignty. It just seemed to me, upon a cursory reading of the manifesto, that it was something that I, broadly speaking, agreed with. But I did say that my understanding is that the spheres are not completely impermeable, that there is permeability between the spheres. Also, again, this is probably an issue of ecclesiology largely. I have more of an Anglo-Catholic ecclesiology, so I would see the Church of England as being part of the Catholic Church, small c Catholic Church, and so being constituted not by Parliament, primarily by Parliament and the Sovereign, although they would have a role, but by the historic episcopate and the sacraments of the Church and by the preaching of the Word and so on and so forth. So I think that would be where I would start. But don't get me wrong, John, I didn't write the statement and I wouldn't die for it. So that's what I would say. Can I come back to this thing about the concern about state overreach? Now, we are living seemingly on the other side of this. And as I say, we've got Sunak and the Prime Minister Liz Truss seemingly distancing themselves from what happened. And I consider that to be really, really good. And I hope that the conversation moves on and that people see that what happened, broadly speaking, was catastrophic and that it will never happen again. The most worrying moment for me was when there was talk of vaccine passports being imposed in our churches. And indeed, I was involved in writing a letter which almost 2,000 church leaders signed, expressing serious concern about this. Now, that to my mind would be a moment. If that had happened, that would have been a moment where a line was crossed in an unambiguous way, where the government was asking the church to divide the body of Christ on the basis of a distinction which they were making, a man-made distinction. Now, to my mind, that would be a serious step away, let's say, from what we're commanded to do in Scripture, from the very heart and essence of the gospel. And I don't want to give myself too much credit. I don't know how much effect our letter had. It was in all the mainstream press. It was picked up by the BBC and so on and so forth. And so I like to think that we had some impact there. I don't know, perhaps I'm being naive, but that was seriously, seriously worrying. And that was a time when it would have been nice to hear from somebody in the hierarchy saying, hang on a second, even though, you know, I think this about the vaccine and, or whatever it might have been, nevertheless, we cannot have the government telling us that we have to turn away people from churches because they've not been vaccinated. So Lord willing, we will continue to have religious liberty and this kind of thing will not happen in this country. But the very fact that was being suggested was, to me, a serious concern.
John, what was your thoughts on that particular suggestion?
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that it didn't happen is an indication of the value we place on civil liberties in the UK. I think there was, on a whole variety of issues, a lot of lobbying behind the scenes of government to not introduce. So I was involved in a group that met with government ministers regularly of church leaders across the whole spectrum and lobbying on things like face coverings, singing, vaccine passports, wanting that not to be introduced. So I take the point that perhaps some of the hierarchy didn't speak in public in quite the way that we might have wanted. But there's also a challenge for the church, actually. It's important to reflect on the difference between campaigning with government to influence its policy and what you then do if government implements that particular policy. And again, I think it's a matter of judgment. The desire to have vaccine passports was, in the circumstances, actually out of a motivation to want to enable society to open up. Now, you might think that's not necessary. And in the end, quite rightly, government decided it wasn't kind of necessary. So again, I want to be slightly careful to be absolutist and say that in no circumstances could that ever be needed. Interestingly, the kind of Frankfurt Declaration, one of its principles is nobody can ever be coerced by the state to be vaccinated. Interestingly, I was reading a book by Simon Heffer called High Minds, which is a history of Victorian England. I hadn't realised this, but actually vaccination of children in the 19th century was made compulsory by law. And that had the consequence of eliminating a wide variety of diseases that caused significant kind of infant mortality. So at one level, again, I want to be not drawing an absolutist principle. I don't think the theological principle automatically determines one single outcome on that question. And I think it is a judgment call. Now, my judgment call at the time at which government was making that proposal was it wasn't the right call. And that's what government chose to do. So I just want to navigate very carefully the distinction between an absolute position and what is in effect a position of a kind of judgment and wisdom in the circumstances. And I think that reflects on something we've talked about, which is this whole language of state overreach. That's not the way that I articulate the relationship between church and state and when we should obey and when we shouldn't. I think lots of things we do as Christians and in life are not mandated by the Bible. They're judgments that we make within the parameters of the Bible, but we make our own choices as to what we want to do. I think my fear with the language of overreach is it seems to say that if the state does something that we don't think it has the power to do, that gives us the right to disobey, even if that's actually only impinging on a free choice that the Bible doesn't mandate. Now, that again reflects an American context. That's the essence of the American Revolution and how American Christians justify the rebellion against the kind of British and the War of Independence. This whole idea that government is limited, and if government exceeds the scope of its authority, you've got a right, if not a duty, to rebel. I don't think that's particularly biblical. I think the way the Bible thinks about it is God raises up the government that we've got, and we have a duty to submit and obey to the authorities unless there is a direct conflict with what Christ commands us to do. And what Christ commands us to do is not the same as what we think we would like to do in our kind of human judgments. So differentiating that, is government impinging on my free choice, or is government requiring me to disobey Christ, is exactly the area to be navigated, I think, in this kind of scenario.
I find that somewhat... it's somewhat questionable, I would say, John. It may be that we don't have enough time to go into this too deeply theologically, but if we look at Romans 13, for example, it's clear that God gives the authority to the civil authorities, let's say. It's given by God, but it's for a specific purpose, isn't it? It's for justice and order in society. It's not just arbitrarily to tell people what to do. So, for example, if the government said, right, well, everyone needs to go outside on Thursday morning and hop on one leg, I mean, that would be, it wouldn't, maybe exceeding the limits of their authority is a wrong language, but it would be an inappropriate use of the authority. Do you not see a category for something like that?
I do, but of course, the reality is that that's the kind of example that no government is likely to do. I just think when I read the New Testament texts, Romans 13, 1 Peter chapter 2, Titus, the message is to the Christians to submit, obey, honour and respect. That, in a sense, refusing to obey is an extreme position. The church occasionally takes that when they're commanded not to speak in the name of Christ or whatever. But I don't think we should forget that the governments that are being described there are the Roman Empire and its authorities. And you have to say, in our terms, massive overreach on the part of those governments in the way that they regulate lives. They're hardly sort of just, equitable, fair governments in the way that we're used to. And yet those are the very governments that the New Testament is instructing Christians to submit to. So as I read those texts, you're absolutely right. They talk about the ideal of what government is for. But in a flawed world, we know that we fall short of that. But I think what's striking about those New Testament passages is submission and obedience is being urged to governments that quite clearly have overreached within the categories of those who believe in sphere sovereignty and this idea of kind of a limited government power.
I mean, are you worried, Jamie, that there is a sort of nefarious intention behind the government, that actually they are trying to kind of test the waters and see how much they can get away with? Are you worried that this could lead to further impingements? I don't know. You know, obviously, lots of people are often worried about whether churches being able to hold a traditional Orthodox view of sexuality, for instance, you know, is something that can be done, you know, in the society we live in. Is that, do you see that as the next battleground? What's your
thought? I'd be hesitant to predict what the next battleground would be, but I would certainly say that the constitutional setup of our nation and many nations in the West, including America, is predicated on the Christian view that human beings are sinful, and when you give them power, that power inevitably corrupts them. All power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, as I believe it was Lord Acton who said. So this is why we have a limited executive. This is why we have checks and balances and so on and so forth. So the problem is when people are given an extraordinary amount of power in extenuating circumstances, it becomes very hard for them to give up that power or to see that power in perspective. No one's saying it's a sort of, something which is done intentionally or anything like that, although it may very well be, who knows. But we are saying that there's a danger, or I'm saying that there's a danger when people have that kind of power, and that indeed our whole political system is predicated on that observation, which I think is a deeply Christian one. In terms of my sort of immediate concerns, as I say, at the moment things seem Okay, but it could be the case that as an Orthodox Christian view on something like sexuality or human biological sex becomes increasingly unacceptable, and indeed it is becoming increasingly unacceptable in society, even to the point of becoming in some cases illegal to manifest these views, I do think there's a serious challenge, I think, coming down the road unless things change. And of course I hope there's a Christian revival in this nation and that the nation turns around. But unless that does happen and we carry on going in this direction, I do think there are going to be serious challenges ahead for Orthodox Christians. Yeah.
Can I come back on that, Justin? I think one of the things that worries me is that I think focusing on COVID and everything that happened in relation to COVID seems to me to be a danger of distracting us from where the real battles are. Because I actually think there are really serious religious liberty issues that are going to impact on the church. And there are points at which we may need to exercise civil disobedience. COVID, for me, I think there was a reasonable approach the government took. I think it lasted far too long. And some of the restrictions on what churches could do, singing, face masks and stuff, should have gone earlier. But at one level, I think it is the issue of human sexuality. It's the place of the gospel in society. I think that the proposals on conversion therapy that are coming, which could very easily severely restrict the ability of Christian ministers to care for those who are struggling with same-sex attraction, the idea that banning praying with somebody who's struggling with a temptation, the restriction on preaching about human sexuality. We started talking about the problems of the church hierarchy. There's a case going on at the moment of a chaplain of a school who was basically dismissed because of preaching or a human sexuality or from a biblical perspective. I don't know the full details, but it's been reported that the Bishop of Derby and others have submitted evidence to the tribunal that's going on, saying that actually that teaching is a safeguarding risk. Well, if the church is making it's stating that its own Orthodox position on human sexuality is a safeguarding risk, then what's going to stop the government from preventing churches from preaching and teaching and helping people who are struggling with issues of sexuality? I think that's where the real battle will come for issues of religious liberty. And rather like Christians in Victoria, in Australia and in Canada, we're going to have to make choices as to whether or not we obey government restrictions on gospel ministry or whether we're willing to disobey. Now, that's the point at which I think there's a clear conflict between what Christ commands the church to do and what the state is saying the church should do. And I don't want to get lost in debates about COVID over an issue which seems to be more of a judgment on a health public safety issue. And actually, I think we need to be helping and equipping Christians to face those very real challenges that I think are potentially going to have significant implications for churches in the coming years.
Yep. I completely agree with John. We covered Bernard Randall's case in the last episode of Irreverent, and it really is extraordinary to hear a safeguarding officer within the Church of England saying that not only the church's teachings constitute a safeguarding risk, but the church itself constitutes a safeguarding risk. It is absolutely shocking and very worrying.
Well, perhaps we'll have many more debates, I'm sure, are due on those sorts of issues as we go forward. As you say, those are the bigger long-term issues that the church is going to be approaching. But for now, Jamie and John, thank you very much for being so gracious in your interactions on this particular
thank show. You Justin, thank you John,
thank you.
You're very welcome to send me in your thoughts on today's discussion. I know this is one that has really polarised a lot of people in the world, not least Christians as well. So do send your thoughts in. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Let me know your thoughts. Over on Twitter, why not tweet to our new Twitter account, @unbelievablefe, and follow us there as well. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/premierunbelievable as well. Thanks to everyone who's been getting in touch since we aired last week's show on church leadership and abuse scandals. The panel discussion that we had live with a lot of listeners, Rachel Den Hollander, Amy Orr Ewing, Diane Langberg and Mike Cosper were all guests on that show. Kate Trotman tweeted, "Misuse of church leadership power in the UK is far from solved, so we do need this discussion. I'm part of a church too, and I'm not here to bring people down. I'm here because I've witnessed leaders in an independent church have total power over info and decisions in very harmful ways." Over on YouTube, lots of appreciative comments there. Daryl, what an amazing panel discussion. Please do another program like this. Many people will find hope. Anthony said, "This is the first time I've heard Rachel Dale Hollander speak. Thoroughly impressed by her biblical acumen, her theological instincts, and her very realistic approach to depravity. That is really good stuff." Also goes on to say, "I donated a lot of money to Arzim in the past, a lot of money. I was told at one of the founders' weekends, where Arzim used to invite its major donors, that Ravi was innocent of the 2017 allegations by Laurie Thompson. At that time, the Thompson incident was the only one I was aware of, and the allegations of his faking his academic credentials. I had no idea at that time about Ravi's visits to massage therapy, his ownership of various spas, nor his frequent long trips to places like Bangkok, where it seems many of his other abuses occurred. As incredibly disappointing as the entire Arzim scandal has been, however, it doesn't seem to have affected my faith in Christ one bit. But in the church, we must beware, for the devil has infiltrated the church from the start. Why God allows this, I don't know, but he does." Keita says, "Thanks for doing these. I'm an adult survivor of clergy sexual misconduct. I've been ostracized by my church and silenced, left to figure out my own healing. They framed the abuse as an affair and allowed the congregation to run with that narrative. I am my own advocate. It's tough, but I will not give up. Thank you." Merge P says, "I like the suggestion from Rachel Dale Hollander on how church leadership communicate their policies and procedures on abuse as preventative measures against predators and creating safe places and awareness for the flock." EC says, "The question isn't the existence of sex abuse. The question is what is done once abuse or the allegations of abuse are revealed. The reason the Catholic Church has been discredited so much and so repeatedly is because of their systematic cover-up of the abuse, how they hid and moved around the abusers. Abusing priests should have been automatically shamed, excommunicated, and turned to the secular authorities so they may rot in jail. Not doing this takes all of the Church's alleged moral standing away." Finally, Christy says, "It's so nice to see Amy or Ewing in this panel. I had watched an apologetics conference with Abdu Murray, John Lennox and Ravi Zacharias. I listened to it over and over again. As soon as the scandal hit, all the content was immediately removed, quite rightly. But I had memorized a lot of it. Amy's portion was on the historicity of the New Testament, and I didn't know her name. I looked and looked, finally found her name and her books so I could order them. Thank you. But I know it was devastating for you." Thank you very much for all of those responses to that show from last week. Again, you can catch that on the podcast or over on the video channel at premierunbelievable.com. Just time as well for a few responses to the show of the week before that. Dale Allison joined me as we asked, "Can skeptics take religious experiences seriously?" He's got a really interesting new book out on that, Encountering Mystery. Here's Carl P, who tweeted, "I take them seriously. I had many experiences that at the time I considered being the presence of God. That humans have had these experiences with countless gods over recorded history makes it clear humans are capable of falsely interpreting such experiences." And in a similarly skeptical light, True Unbeliever says, "I had a bathed in Christ's love experience at a Jesus festival in 1978. It was a very real and life-changing experience, but now I know that it was 100% a psychological experience caused by dopamine, endorphins, oxytocin, and serotonin." So there you go. A couple of views there on Twitter. Robert in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I mean, Kalamazoo has to be one of the best place names in the world, doesn't it? But Robert emails in to say, "Just listen to this week's Unbelievable podcast with Dale discussing angels' visions and near-death encounters. 7 years ago today, I was in the middle of what I can only call a profound religious experience that occurred as a series of supernatural events each evening and some mornings over a period of 2 weeks. In many ways, these pieces resembled some of the experiences described in your podcast, and I, like Dale and others he mentioned, was left with intense feelings about the reality and genuineness of what I was experiencing. Unlike the religious experiences he described, that first religious experience of mine unfolded in episodes lasting about 20 minutes to a few hours. They shifted in character from irresistibly interesting to terrifyingly evil to frustratingly confusing to gloriously transforming, and that was just the first week, when finally all of these puzzle pieces suddenly arranged themselves to reveal a profound truth about my relationship to God. By the end of the second week, which was equally supernaturally dramatic as the first, I knew I had to start attending church and begin learning a lot to try and understand what had happened to me. It became clear that God had proactively begun a relationship with me and that he had every intention of continuing it as I learned and evolved. So much has happened since then, including another major religious experience and several less dramatic ones. When I asked my mentor, a retired Methodist pastor who conveniently appeared in my life just weeks after my first experience, what I should do with all of this, he replied, "I think you should find a publisher." I've been struggling since then to try and write a book about all I've experienced during the last several years. Only recently have I felt like I finally broke the ice jam that's been stalling me. And then your podcast about many other people having religious experiences conveniently appeared just yesterday, as if to spur me on. I now feel more determined than ever to get this done as soon as possible. I should mention that prior to my experiences, I had been agnostic and quite antipathetic to religion in general and Christianity in particular for more than 40 years. And had retired from a career as a scientist with a doctorate in chemistry. Consequently, what happened to me 7 years ago was completely unexpected and completely changed my life as I began a slow, intellectual, and often reluctant walk towards Christianity. Thanks so much for this and the many other offerings in Unbelievable and its sister podcast. While people like my former agnostic self and other non-believers will probably never be logically convinced about the existence of God or the correctness of Christianity just by listening to your episodes, perhaps many will be primed in such a way that will facilitate proactive interventions by God into their lives, such as those described by Dale. What an interesting story, Robert, in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Thank you for writing in. Interesting perspective again here as well from Paul Rimmer, who's a Christian and a postdoc at Cambridge, but with a sort of, you know, more skeptical view on whether you can always attribute supernatural sort of explanations to these experiences. Paul says, I enjoyed your interview with Dale. As someone who has had both top of the mountain experiences and many sleep paralysis experiences, I found the discussion fascinating and we'll have to look up Dale's book. As a counterpoint to Dale's observation that it is uncharitable to dismiss people's experiences out of hand, I think it's also uncharitable to dismiss people's skepticism about these experiences out of hand. Skepticism that is often rooted in the real and valid experience of the skeptic. Religious experiences can be infuriating for the skeptic hearing about the experience because they are, for the most part, private and subjective experiences that may sometimes connect to objective reality, but are unshareable and unreproducible. Even judging purely from my own experiences, I would have to conclude that some experiences make contact with the transcendent objective reality of God and heaven, and some don't. My mountaintop experience is the main reason I'm a Christian today, but I'm almost certain that my sleep paralysis experiences are completely a function of genetics and neurochemistry. In fact, when Dale brought up sleep paralysis, describing almost exactly my frequent experience of being unable to move, feeling a presence in the room, seeing a creature sitting on my chest, it never occurred to me that someone would even entertain the notion that there really was some dark spiritual component to the experience. In my case, it runs in my family, is known to have a genetic component, and is comorbid with various cardio and neurological conditions. It's so mundane, uncorrelated with anything else going on in my life, and so regular, there's no way I think the content of the experience itself has anything whatsoever to do with some external spiritual world or heaven and hell. If I can dismiss some of my experiences and embrace others, how can I be insulted by others' dismissal of some or all of my experiences? I think it's great to have an open mind about the potential veracity of some of these experiences, and one can and maybe should be open to non-material explanations for any of these experiences. At the same time, an open mind needs always to be open to the possibility that the content of many or most or almost all of these experiences is unconnected with anything outside the thoughts, emotions, and active imagination of the experiencer. Thanks, Paul. Lots of interesting commentary on this. Maybe just time for one more. Matthew Arnold, not the Victorian poet, I assume, but someone who's an interesting person by the looks of your email here, Matthew. You say, thanks for the show. I was catching up with Dale Allison on the near-death experiences. I am the editor of the Christian Parapsychology Journal, an international journal that's nearly 50 years old. We've often published articles on near-death experiences, as well as some of the stranger things which often get reported in the lead-up to a person's death, including deathbed visions of the already departed and other high strangeness of a paranormal persuasion which occurs at these times. The CP, Christian Parapsychology Journal, is a publication of the Church's Fellowship for Psychical and Spiritual Studies, itself 70 years old next year, and has among its patrons Rowan Williams and Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, and doesn't have any associations with spiritualist churches, despite what some might think from the name. Anyway, it exists partly to help those who have had spiritual or religious experiences and who have often found the church rejecting their experiences due to its lack of knowledge and training in how to address them. My own master's thesis, Paranormal Hauntings and Applications in Deliverance Ministry, a Critical Investigation, recently received 82% from Manchester University and is part of the basis of my website, ghostschoolsandgod.co.uk, and work I'm currently performing for a book that's been commissioned on that subject. Anyway, would you be interested in having someone on the show who's an educated and committed Christian that doesn't run away from the issue of paranormals, hauntings, ghosts, and other strange things like this, and who attempts to bring his thinking about these issues under the Lordship of Christ? Well, that would be you, Matthew, I assume. And yeah, I would actually. Sounds fascinating. Why don't we see what we can do? Be really interesting to perhaps bring someone like yourself on opposite a skeptic when it comes to things, especially like ghosts, hauntings, the paranormal. You know, that was an area we really didn't discuss with Dale in any depth. But yeah, great stuff. Loads of interesting response there, as ever. You can email in your thoughts, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or tweet us to our new social media account at unbelievablefe on Facebook. We're facebook.com/premierunbelievable. You can get all of those links and all of our resources, podcasts, articles, courses, and much more at our website, premierunbelievable.com. All that remains for now is to say thanks for listening. Let me tell you what's coming up next time. How should we understand Old Testament violence? Paul Copan has written a lot on this issue over the years, and his newest book is titled Is God a Vindictive Bully?, aimed at reconciling portrayals of God in the Old and New Testaments. Well, Randall Rouser, who's been on the show just recently, thinks that many apologists like Copan are trying to defend the indefensible. His recent book, God Loves Canaanites, outlines a new way of understanding Old Testament violence in light of Jesus. That's on Unbelievable next week. Hope you can be here. For now, thanks for being with us.